Awesome. Hi, everybody. This is Dean Haglund from the heart of the Los Feliz grassy area known as the
Los Feliz grassy area.
Don't I sound like I'm
taking
out JFK?
Hey, that's Dean Haglund.
And that's Phil Lernes.
And this is your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
We didn't even rehearse that.
Good night.
We're coming to you right now.
Well, we hope we are.
We know we
are. After the events of the last week.
I can't explain a technical difficulty. And what a worse time for it to happen when I am completely in the most remote regions of the Alps. That's all I can say. I apologize to everyone.
Well, it was truly a cursed show because we were talking, of course, about last week's Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Yes.
That is now available.
It is.
Everywhere. I mean, it was first heard on Jackalope Radio. Jackaloperadio.com.
Mm-hmm.
It is available, of course, on our official site where you can download every episode we've ever done or stream it. And even subscribe via iTunes.
In fact, it'll show up on iTunes today.
It's chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com. And it was Chillpack Hollywood Hour 173.
The 173. Or, as it shows up at, oddly enough, at Jackalope Radio, episode 007.
Oh, and it was the theme show. All about 007. After we finished a little discussion of a question from listener, anyway, the thing about this show is that we were pre-recording it because, of course, you were traveling, you were on the continent in the Alps, as
in
you say.
The Alps, yeah.
And
pre-Alps, I guess.
We had once done back in the summer of 07,
yeah,
a theme show all about 007.
I know,
and only about 7 minutes of that show actually exist.
That's right.
So we decide finally, after all these years and after people saying, you know, we'd love to hear that show. Well, we don't know whatever happened to it. We don't know why it's not available. So we'll redo it. What a perfect opportunity to do it. The James Bond franchise is at a standstill right now, even though it's never been more popular.
Absolutely.
And so why don't we? And there is some kind of James Bond curse right now.
With the podcast and us.
Well, they're cursed because even though the show's more successful, the films are more successful than ever, the parent company, MGM, that owns the distribution rights, because of their problems, Bond is in limbo. We can't seem to get a podcast about it up. I mean,
well, it's up now.
Yeah.
Clearly it got up last night
it's
around
some
6
sort of Spectre plot.
Oh, I blame Blofeld. That evil genius.
So it is up. Thank God.
It's finally up.
So anyway, and thank you, of course, to Jackalope Radio
for
making the show available.
And you know, it was interesting because when I did finally find an internet connection, I could get into Jackalope's FTP site, but not Farpoint Media. Isn't that odd? For some reason, France and Farpoint Media don't like each other.
Oh.
I don't know why.
Perhaps it means Farpoint Media is more secure than Jackalope? Perhaps it means that Jackalope Radio is simply more friendly. We don't know.
What are you trashing?
There are other possibilities. Yeah. I'm throwing out. I'm now the conspiracy theorist.
Look at you.
I'm
go.
I'm going to say whatever the kid that made loose change, the disingenuous thing that he said. What was it? I'm just asking questions. That's all I'm doing. I'm just asking questions.
Just asking questions.
I have no agenda.
No agenda whatsoever.
I'm just asking questions.
How is it? Yeah. Awesome. So,
you know, I'm mentioning loose change, by the way. It was 9/11. It was the 9th anniversary of 9/11.
I missed the
How
whole thing.
How did you commemorate it?
A silent bike ride in the mountains. Clearly, I had no access to any media whatsoever. So I sort of biked. I think I went up 700 meters.
So France,
yeah,
where of course 9/11 9 years ago was a big deal.
It was a big deal. Yep.
You know, the headlines in all the papers, you know, talking about how America became really family again,
right,
to France after having become really the unthinkable, which was merely an ally,
right. And we named our...
That relationship had become so strained.
That we called our French fries Freedom Fries.
So what... but I think that was afterwards. That was after the relationship soured again.
Oh, right.
Right.
Yeah, that is right.
So anyway, it was there any, I mean, I guess not. I guess you would have realized it, but yeah. there was no mention.
There was no, of course, I wasn't in any major center. So
I got to tell you, I had this desire. And I mean, it's just become such a big deal, 9/11, you know, commemorating it every year in a way that I'm not old enough to remember. But it happened. But it seems like was Pearl Harbor Day always commemorated? I mean,
December 7th? Did we all stop everything and?
It never became kind of a national holiday, a de facto national holiday, which I feel like 9/11 has become.
Yeah. Well, we commemorated all of World War II and everything in Armistice Day, wasn't it? Oh no, that was World War I, November 11th.
Yeah, that's Veterans Day. All war. Yeah, I mean, it's not like we celebrate Victory in Europe Day or Victory in Japan Day. I mean, it's mentioned this date in history.
Right.
Anyway, I don't know that, you know, if this is going to offend a lot of people or whatever, but I so find myself more and more with each passing year, just want to like go up to everybody I meet. Happy 9/11.
Hey!
Because you know, I just feel like it's becoming almost that, you know, like, where are the 9/11 cakes?
Right.
You know, and I did. I went to an event over at Olandar, hosted by our friend Lee McCloskey, and I kind of went in expecting there to be, like, cakes and desserts served.
And what was there?
They're commemorating... Solemn? Commemorating the day through kind of a thematic discussion over what the day really meant, what 9/11 really meant.
Hmm.
And we'll get into this in a minute, but I did on the way stop at Pepperdine University.
As one does.
And I don't know if you've ever seen this before, and I don't know how many years now they've been doing this, but it's really extraordinary. On that lawn, that massive lawn slopes up to the school,
yeah,
all the way down to the PCH,
yeah,
which is on the bluffs overlooking the ocean, and Cher's house, as you've pointed out to me.
Numerous times.
There was a flag planted for each and every victim.
Wow.
Who died in the attacks.
2,600 some odd flags?
700, I think. 2,782, something like that.
Sure.
And each flag was the flag of the nation representing the nationality of each victim. So there were Canadian flags, for example. I think weren't the second most victims Canadian. And so you would see these different national flags interspersed among the... Anyway, it was... extraordinary. And along the PCH, where of course there's no stopping, all these cars just pulling over and stopping.
Good
and
God.
Seeing this, and you know, really it was quite an extraordinary sight.
Yeah.
Seeing them all flapping in the breeze, and you know, to turn to the people who would stop and just kind of, you know, you were motivated to just say hi and have an interaction. Happy
9/11. Happy 9/11.
No, to have some kind of interaction and like, what do you think of that? Isn't that amazing? And I guess they have a little ceremony at the beginning. They do, you know, a 21-gun salute.
Oh, they do?
Amazing Grace and Taps are played on bagpipe.
Yes.
No less.
The only way you should hear it.
Anyway, that was really...
That's something.
That's how you commemorate.
That's exactly how you commemorate.
Something.
That's a visual symbol. That's a deal. That sounds right.
At the ocean,
yeah.
Also... you know, this very symbolic, all the energy, and of course, still to this day, there's so much energy surrounding those events that no one really seems to, a lot of people have, we don't know how to process all these different energies.
Right.
And one of the things, you know, that we get to experience living so close to the ocean, of course, is in our life when we're feeling struggling with really diverse energies that we don't seem to know what to do with or that might be tearing us apart. You know, you go down, you walk the beach.
Right.
You're thinking things through.
That's how
And what you find really, and you feel it in a very tangible way, the ocean can take that energy.
That's right. In fact, what do crystal healers do? They take the crystals to the ocean, wash out the energy.
I did not know that.
Yes, that's how you recharge your crystals. as it were. Now, I recall...
Now, I replaced the crystals that you usually use with Folgers crystals. See what I did there?
Barely. Well, here's the 9/11 commemoration I remember from 4 years ago, I think, 2004, maybe. I was flying through Heathrow, and they said, hey, everybody, we're going to stop for 2 minutes, have 2 minutes of silence in the airport. Well, what could be more embarrassing than the fact they only announced it in English? So, being international, everyone just kept walking who couldn't understand what the hell... And then people
from Islamic countries.
Yeah, well, no, the Japanese tourists, like, you know, this global center point, which is Heathrow Airport, and that they have like 2 minutes of silence for some start of a, you know, terrorist action. And at the same time, nobody listening, like only the employees would just bow their heads for 2 minutes while the Japanese are asking, which way to my flight? And, you know, and people late for their flights running while 2 minutes of silence going on. And it just seemed, now that was highly, to me, highly inappropriate way to commemorate that. It seemed usual, yes, 2 minutes of silence of solemn for those who passed away. But to do it at, you know, international airport, it was incongruous at best. And flags, 2,700 flags sounds more reasonable way of doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's great.
And then you get to come to it.
Voluntarily.
And in your own way, and with whatever particular energy that you have. I mean, yeah. You see it, and you saw so many different people taking photos or whatever, and it's like, you know, if you want to go and you want to run through the flags, run up the field, and that would not be out of place.
Absolutely.
If you want to, as I was motivated to do, remove my hat and put my hat over my heart and have a moment taking in all the flags, you know, whatever it is.
And regardless whether the conspiracies and the truthers or whatever, that you still are respecting those who died in however...
And that's really something, you know, there was a History Channel piece about what happened on 9/11 and analyzing really these conspiracy theories, and I was really struck by the pieces with the Loose Change creator, you know, how the third edition of Loose Change is coming out, and they've disavowed almost all the theories from the first one. They're really focusing now, they've gone away from 9/11, from the towers as possibly being, you know, they've backed away from the idea, realizing that the towers could not have been what do you call it? With the explosives.
Detonations, the thermite.
Yeah, but controlled demolition.
Controlled demolition.
And they're focusing much more on Building 7. And you know, and so it was interesting in this way, and, you know, but it still kind of, it struck me, you know, a couple of things that everybody just needs to take the chaos of what happened and put it in some sort of sense of order. Everybody needs to do this. And
yeah,
if your way
nature.
Of doing that is through the official story, or if your way of doing it is to disbelieve the official story, it's still all about blind belief, because you know, all they're doing is that they're tearing apart an official version and then authoring an entirely alternate version with really much less evidence.
Right.
And of course, as you've pointed out, the reason that you can justify that there is less evidence is, well, that's part of the cover-up. That's part
the
of the
cover
conspiracy.
Up itself, yeah.
But both are still about believing one version or another because of this need that we have to take chaos and create order out of it.
To have a reason why this happened. Why did that happen?
And yet we don't so often go to the real question, which is the reason of why did it happen.
Right.
And that's where you have to start peeling back the layers. And it's not about why did it happen in terms of who did it. That's a criminal investigation.
Right.
As with most of life, the real meaning can be only understood when we start to approach it mythically.
Yeah.
You know, what did it mean that this happened? Why did this have to happen? Why was this going to happen? You know, the idea that whether you believe that it was terrorists or whether you believe it was the government, not that these questions are unimportant,
right.
Not that the questions ever of bringing people who are culpable to some sort of sense of justice. Not that those are ever meaningless or irrelevant or unimportant. At the same time, you're never going to root it out by finding the quote-unquote guilty parties.
Right.
You cannot punish criminals enough to stop crime.
Right. There will always be crime.
You can never root out and remove and eliminate the violent
person
to get rid of violence.
Right.
You know, the
death penalty does not.
In other words,
murder.
No matter what we have collectively agreed upon is acceptable, you will never be able to eliminate the unacceptable individuals or groups enough to root out that which you find unacceptable.
Right.
One of my favorite, you know, lines in cinema, not even the Nazis could kill that fast. To get rid of that which they deemed undesirable.
Undesirable.
Right?
Right.
And
This is Durkheim's necessity of crime, that every society has to develop what is crime and what's not, so that when you approach an individual, you have already shorthanded that you will not be killed by that individual because you've already agreed that that is what crime and what is punishment, so that you can have interactions with people in shorthand and not have to frisk everybody and give them metal detectors.
Interesting.
And
I think it's really important to approach this mythically. You know, when I'm doing violence prevention work, mm-hmm. one of the first things is the importance of defining violence.
Yeah.
And in violence prevention work, in the violence prevention movement, it's to define violence as to not demonize violence.
Right.
Violence is not per se bad. Violence is any act, energy, or force that injures, harms, or destroys. Not any act, energy, or force by people that injures, harms, or destroys people. Because,
right.
of course, animals can be the victims of violence. Property can be the victims of violence.
Structures.
But also to take away the authorship that it's purely people.
Right.
Right?
Whether.
Groups.
Group,
whether mom. Nature. Isn't nature violent? One of the first things we always say about a really bad storm that wreaks destruction.
Violent storm.
It was a violent storm. Absolutely. Katrina was a violent storm. Did it mean to be violent and destructive? No, it was a storm.
Right.
It meant to be a storm.
Right.
It's part of nature, and therefore it's part of all of our nature. When you start to look at it from the standpoint that these are energies that injure, harm, or destroy, or acts that injure, harm, and destroy, and how can we make choices that will not lead to injury, harm, or destruction? Then you start to get deeper into more mythical realms. And with 9/11, again, it's, you look at all the stories. If you can step beyond the idea of, the lone gunman pilot talked about an attack on the World Trade Center, they must have been in on it.
Right.
Or, again, Tom Clancy wrote about it. The film that I was working on, the behind-the-scenes documentary about hijacked airliners being flown into the world's largest skyscrapers. You know, it was in the collective. It was in the zeitgeist because we all knew something was coming.
Right. You could feel it.
And so why did it need to happen? And until you start to understand it from that sense, that what was going on in the collective, what was bubbling up in that crucible that was heating up, why did it need to happen? Until you start to ask those questions, then you can never, ever hope to be free from that particular story.
Wow. Wow. So my freedom from my story, or that story, is when I stop asking.
Well, you start to redeem it. Ah. When you really start to redeem it by saying the horrible question of what's right about it.
Yes.
Why did these towers need to fall?
Ouch.
And so that was what we were discussing a great deal of at Lee McCloskey's. You know, he has his world archetype when he was revisioning the Tarot since the 80s, right? And in 1986, he did the world archetype. And the architectural pillars of the world archetype that he drew were twin towers.
Ah.
And what date did he do that drawing on? He did it on 9/11, 1986.
Good God.
15 years. Or was it 17 years?
17
I don't remember.
Years.
It might have been 84. four. But whichever the point, it was 9/11 he dated the Twin Tower drawing of the world archetype. And to him, as he was doing this, and then what was announced on 9/11, it was all about how this dualistic way of viewing things needed to fall away.
Right.
The traditional conflict between religion and business.
Right.
Which was so represented by 9/11.
Yeah.
No matter how you look at it, whether it was terrorists attacking the corporate imperialism of the West, or if you believe that it was a government using religious fundamentalists as scapegoats,
right?
Isn't that still that battle?
Same battle.
The battle for supremacy between corporate interests and religious interests, each greedily hungering for what the other has.
Wow. I gotta say, you spent your and Saturday well spent, sir.
Well, and this is, and it is, and this for me then is 9/11, because I was one of those not asking how could such a thing happen on 9/11. I never asked that question.
Right.
The question that really poured cold water down my back was, why doesn't this happen more often?
Ah.
And so I start to look at history not as the history of wars or the history of political or geopolitical or socioeconomic battles.
Right.
I start to look at history of art, the history of human beings through the stories that we tell.
Right.
Because after all, isn't that fundamentally what we do hold up? Look what expressions of being alive, what it means to be alive, humanity created. And sometimes they're being created in the direct response to these
events of the day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's true, because when traveling through France, we did the Impressionist tour. And sure enough, you saw the culture of the 1800s all through how France was sort of the world power at that point, which was quite interesting, and how that expression came out through modernity and all the art expressions that came after that. And there was no other, I mean, it was, you could see a bit in the architecture, but there was no other way of actually learning that except through art, which is fascinating.
And, you know, everybody gets so wrapped up. We all get wrapped up in the battle that we believe is important.
Right.
Again, to live mythically and to appreciate the mythical underpinnings of everything that takes place is to appreciate that, okay, no matter how drawn into this battle you are, recognize that it is no different than any battle that has ever taken place throughout human history.
Right.
The political reasons might be different. The personal reasons might make it personal. However, isn't every conflict, whether it be a religious conflict, whether it be an economic conflict, a legal conflict, whatever it is, isn't it always about the need of rules to create order from chaos coming into conflict versus the need for freedom?
Just to be free.
Yeah, in order to express and blossom in uniqueness. That always comes into conflict. Because the truth is, we need both.
Right.
We need rules. We need freedom.
Yeah.
We need the father, the pater familias, right?
Right.
Pater, patter, which is where we get the word pattern.
Ah, look at you go.
Right? We also need mother, right? Which is where we get matter. And the word matter from that.
Right. Interesting. So then that conflict, that duality then between structure and anarchy, whatever.
Well, rules.
Rules.
The need for rules versus the need for freedom.
Right. But freedom, I can still have freedom within a series of rules, can't I?
Well, I would argue that maybe you can't have it without the series of rules.
Look at you go.
Because, again, it isn't this or that. How can you have freedom what is freedom if there are no rules?
Then you don't know you're free.
Right.
You're trapped in your own
You're trapped chaos. In a world without rules.
You're trapped in a world without rules.
You're trapped in chaos.
How crazy is that?
Yeah, well, that's chaos.
And hey, full circle.
And so again, then it so what is the way out of that kind of, well, it's to then embrace. Appreciate that there is another way of looking at history.
A third
which
way.
Is the, or maybe it's not even a third way. I mean, it's just another. it's just to again, recognize the unfolding story that's taking place about what is it to be human.
Hmm. And that then is the same story told over and over, which is those who
well,
don't
I don't know if it's the same story over and over.
Or if it's one story that keeps going.
Because, you know, I mean, this is the interesting thing. Whether you look at the stories of the Mayans or the ancient Amazon tribes or
right.
the Egyptians or the ancient Greeks
right.
or plays set in the South, you know.
Tennessee Williams.
All of the people in all of these stories are every bit as human as we are.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, when you learn, quote unquote, about the history of those societies, suddenly they seem quite alien,
right.
don't they?
They're far...
Like, that's a different
culture,
race and species from us.
Interesting.
And so yet...
They are so human in their
and yet,
expression
well,
of
well, we're all just human beings.
That's crazy. That's crazy when you learn that. So, wait a second. How did we get here again?
I don't know. How to commemorate...
How to commemorate
9/11.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's a very... I mean, did everybody do that? Did the whole town shut down on the 11th here?
Well, it was a Saturday, right?
Right. So,
but that's why I feel like it is a de facto holiday here now. I feel like...
I guess. Well, I don't know. I didn't experience a thing, so that switched that up.
Wow, we just
France, yeah,
we just spun off the planet Earth.
Look at us go. Now, what should
well, I... Well, and getting right back to the Earth and to news events and controversies, you know, we talked about the controversy surrounding the proposed mosque at Ground Zero.
Right. And I thought that would be over by now.
Well, no, it isn't, because now it finds its counterpoint in the pastor in Florida who...
Burns a Quran a day.
Well, was planning this big Quran burning, and I don't think it took place.
I hope not.
Well, and but, you know, one of the things that came up was the head of, you know, our military actions in Afghanistan.
Petraeus.
Saying, you know, this pastor is putting our boys and girls, our men and women, in harm's way. Because people who would not be our enemy are now targeting us because we are now enemies against Islam.
Right.
You know, and boy, isn't that the sticky wicket when you want to go have wars in the Middle East. How can we do this without making it a religious war?
Absolutely.
Because we don't want that.
We don't want that. This should strictly be an operation.
Let's make that clear right now.
It's all about business.
What is it? Is it business? Or, oh, no, or is it police keeping? I don't know.
I'm not sure what we're doing.
But we're playing in a sandbox and we don't know how to get out of it.
Again.
And we never learned how to play in the sandbox.
Right.
Anyway, so this becomes really interesting, and you know, it's very easy for me to, you know, as we did, to recognize the opportunity for healing that comes from having this mosque being built at Ground Zero. It's very easy for me to, you know, be very much against the pastor in the sense that burning books is never okay.
Never okay. There's never even a good idea, you know.
Because I am someone who tries to really embody that which I've been learning, which is that you have to honor all voices.
All voices.
Our strength is in our diversity.
Absolutely.
And so you have to honor all of them. At the same time, that doesn't mean that you have to invite them all to dinner.
Right.
You're allowed to enjoy ones more than others.
That's fine.
but really honor all voices, because truly our strength is in our diversity. And,
okay,
and that said, though, I really do get to the point that we you know, I choose to live in a world where there is freedom of expression and there is freedom of religion.
Mm-hmm.
And you may choose to, if you wish, speak to a God that speaks to you and speak to that God in your own way.
However you see it fit.
And so that becomes a sticky wicket when you look at this kind of thing. Because couldn't it be shown that that pastor is expressing love to his God
By burning that's his freedom
the book
of expression?
And so if I want to live in a world with freedom that honors all voices, then I do not want to outlaw book burning.
Right.
What I want to be illegal is institutional book burning.
Right.
We do not want the government being able to ban or burn books.
Right. But
individuals need to be allowed to burn books. School districts should not be allowed to burn books.
Right.
Libraries should not be allowed to. Individuals and private enterprise, perhaps we need to allow that in order for freedom to exist.
Well, I hate to say it, but the New York Library does burn about 100,000 books a year, right? Because they don't have the room and or the price. So often it's a poet, the first to go, I've heard. Because
and, of course, people could understand that because, oh, well, there's only so much room.
There's
only so now all you're arguing over is motive. You're
right.
Not arguing over means.
Right. Right.
So the ends justify the means.
Ouch.
Depending on, you know, so it becomes, that's why I say that it's really sticky. And so I think, you know, there's always this deeper question. We need to fight for each other's right to express our own uniqueness, even if our own uniqueness is short-sighted and misguided, because only through that journey will we grow, both as individuals and as children need to be allowed to behave like children.
Right.
If you do not let them behave like children, childhood becomes disowned.
Right.
And anything that becomes disowned
shows up later.
Shows up later because
right.
It's hungry. And you don't feed the snake gets hungry, the snake bites you.
Right. And so you have these child men who are 30 years old on their skateboard.
Floating. Welcome to America of contemporary life.
Right.
And So that then begs this larger question, which is always just because it is all right to do something doesn't make it okay.
Wow.
That's the distinction, and it's such a slight distinction.
That's so slight.
But basically saying that just because you have the right to do something doesn't make it right to do it. You have the freedom to do the wrong thing.
Right.
That doesn't mean that you should do the wrong thing.
Interesting.
We need to have the choice of how to behave in order to be able to come to the right behavior. Otherwise, again, getting back to rules versus freedom, it's just being imposed upon us.
Right.
Wow.
That is tough.
So
you're saying, it was what is right about Quran burning is that it allows for the growth to come through the other side.
Well, certainly this discussion. Yeah, the other side of the discussion. And in fact, now I might advocate, you know, the real opportunity for the people building the mosque is to say, to go and meet with maybe the representatives of the victims.
Mm-hmm.
And who seem, by and large, to actually be the ones who are okay with it.
Okay with it.
But, you know, you hear these polls, and in the wake of 9/11, America really, remarkably, did not have an anti-Islamic sentiment.
Right.
It was almost incredible. The response was not to demonize that group. We understood, look, the worst thing that could happen to us as a people is if we demonize a particular group in response to this.
Right.
Now, yeah. 9 years later, 50% of all Americans have animosity, and they admit to this. So
right.
You know the number's bigger. 50% as opposed to 15% of Americans in the wake of 9/11, 50% now have a negative feeling towards Islam and Muslims.
But that's not from the growth of 9/11. That's from...
That interesting? Because that would seem to mean that the belief system that it was our own government that was behind 9/11, not only does that belief that our government did it is not taking hold.
Right.
You know, the We Are Change, the truth movement is not taking hold, but in fact...
Losing ground. Boy, oh boy.
And why would that be so? I mean, well, one of the things, because again, you get back to, it's just challenging belief systems. It's just belief system versus belief system. It's just outrage placed against one group versus outrage placed against another group.
Right.
So outrage grows. Regardless. Intolerance grows regardless.
And that's coming from the media because it seems that's the easiest way to sell, airtime and get viewership. It's just to be crazy outraged, take a stand, controversial, and blab on it, even if you have no... A, brain in your head, or B.
It's like Glenn Beck, you know, going on his show every day saying he is so sick and tired of the government scaring us and telling us what we need to believe and what we need to do. And then later on in his show, he tells us what we need to do.
and although
he has a lot of hope that makes him cry, he also then gets scared because the time is running out, people.
Yeah.
And the thing is that if I thought he was intelligent, I would then find him to be duplicitous.
Right.
I really don't think he even understands.
I think he's
the perfect spokesperson for our age because there isn't any reflection there.
Right.
There is just this complete dualism, this complete dichotomy, and he goes from one to the other. There is no holding center.
Right. By switching one to the other, he doesn't even realize it. That's how that mercurialness is so shocking.
To bastardize the Dark Knight, right? We don't get the public spokespeople that we need. We get what we deserve.
Yeah, isn't that true? I'm great how you brought that all the way to the Dark Knight movie. Bringing Batman.
Anyway, I can now really see... an opportunity, a deeper opportunity, which would be, you know, the people who are planning to build the mosque. Boy, if they backed away from that.
Yeah, now more
than ever. But not by doing a double turn, but just by maybe coming forth and saying, hey, you know, we really thought that this is an opportunity to...
all of us to grow.
For all of us to build together and all of us to grow and... you know, but in the wake of all of this discussion, you know what? We will build elsewhere. We do apologize if feelings were hurt. Not taking responsibility for those people's feelings.
Right.
But to take responsibility by saying that was never our intention.
Right.
And if we can... get past this, then we will. And oh, by the way, from a business standpoint... I bet you if they did that, they'd get such sweet real estate and development deals from the city elsewhere.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. But it's still, I don't even think those people are New Yorkers. I mean, where are they coming from? Well, enough of that. Now,
talking about all this religious talk, you know, a lot of controversy has been made in recent days while you've been in France over Steve Jobs. And issuing what he called his Ten Commandments,
right,
in the apps business,
making apps
of Apple, yeah. And I showed you these tabs. Yes. I mean, people are kind of seemingly outraged, and it's this whole discussion of, boy, you know, how dare you put rules down?
Well, no porn.
And yet you read these,
yeah, and they all seem reasonable. No porn, no amateurs. Keep it for the clean for the kids.
Don't be mean without a license.
Crude, rude, like all of these things. It's just like, be civil. We're in a, you know, there's a sociological aspect to apps.
And yet there seems to be this response, like Steve Jobs is trying to squelch expression, trying to squash artistic, you know, the sort of thing that sometimes you feel, right?
Right.
Like the man is trying to prevent kind of rebellious nature of my artistic expression.
But just the opposite. By having boundaries, I know what to push against. like Da Vinci said, there is no art without boundaries.
Well, and I can't believe, I mean, but isn't Apple Steve Jobs' company?
Totally.
And isn't the iTunes and iPhones and the Apple Store and all this, aren't they his domain?
And the code that he developed that he gave to an open platform to allow these developers to even create apps is all his domain. So absolutely, he has the right.
So he builds the playground. He invites people to come and play. How dare he create rules? How dare he tell me that this playground is closed from dusk till dawn?
Right. And don't take the shovel and hammer the other kid over the head with the shovel while you're playing in his playground.
Even though he's the one with all the liability of me wielding that shovel, because I got no money.
I got no money.
So if I hit someone with the shovel on his playground, guess who gets sued?
Right, absolutely. So if I make a mean app that is so vicious, he'll get the brunt of it. So I don't understand.
It's like all the outrage, you know, that again, this idea that, oh, you know, all the media is controlled by the CIA. CIA can't seem to actually run a successful operation. How are they going to be able to run the media?
Yeah.
But, you know what I mean? Anyway,
I agree.
This whole thing, you know, like there's no freedom of expression on the, you know, television, you know, how dare the airwaves belong to all of us. It's our right. Says who? A business. Did you invent broadcast television? Yeah. Did you invent cable? Did you invent these things? If you didn't invent the playground, then guess why are you outraged because the man is coming down on your expression?
The FCC had the public access television rule, right? That every station had to have set aside some public access where people would go to that studio in West Hollywood and put on the dumbest shows, idiotic talk shows, and that woman just dancing. Remember, she just danced for half an hour, and then you saw her in a wheelchair on Hollywood Boulevard, and then everybody went, wait a sec, you danced for half an hour. And so to go, you know, hey, they're stopping artistic expression. No, it's enhancing it because you get shows like Mad Men. You get shows like Breaking Bad because they're filtering out the crazy people dancing and the, you know, all of that sort of thing. And I got to think Steve Jobs is doing the same thing, that the apps situation could have quickly devolved into just a plethora of porn and stupid and apps that didn't work and buggered up my iPhone. And that could have just ended the whole apps revolution dead in its tracks. But by the very fact that he's put down the Ten Commandments that were already in place, you already knew, I'm not going to get a filthy, stupid, poorly performing app through their review process. Because it doesn't work and nobody wants it. So by having a Ten Commandments, it's already in place. He's just laying it out for new developers who are coming on board.
Yeah, and no matter what your form of expression is, you know, why should you automatically be allowed on television or to have your film distributed or on radio or whatever it is? Why should you be allowed to? It's, you didn't create it.
Right.
They created it. You created the expression. But
they got the platform.
It's still on you to either luck into other people seeing how they can get value out of it. Usually that means monetary, right? Obviously. Of course, there are some people who just fall in love with something, you know, even in television. Like, I really liked the show, so I went to bat for it.
Right.
I liked this movie. I believed in this movie, so I distributed it.
Right.
I knew that money was not going to be part of the equation, and you'll always get that. But of course, it really boils down to what you've created, your expression, what you have to say, paint, dance, act, film, whatever you have. If it is of value to other people, i.e. people in the distribution avenue, well, then it will find a place.
Right.
And if it isn't, then find your own way to get that expression to people, or find a way to show that that is or could be of value to, quote-unquote, the powers that be.
Create a new platform.
And we see both happening. We see new platforms being created, and at the same time, you know, this gets back to the organic food movement, that we were talking about, that, how a company like Walmart suddenly becomes one of the leading vendors of organic foods.
Right.
Well, they're at a point where they suddenly need a PR overhaul, and these organic food vendors will go to them and say, well, here's an opportunity. You know, your public is demanding this. You need a PR boost. We offer you both. And, oh, by the way, look at our profit margin.
Yeah, right.
Huge. So they get to make money now doing the right thing. Nothing is going to change this world faster than convincing people that they can make money doing the right thing.
Yeah, so true.
You know, it doesn't have to be a fight. Perhaps what you're doing can make money for other people, and all they have to do is do the right thing. And if it doesn't fit, then why rant against it anyway? Come up with a new platform. Come up with something. Come up with a different way to get it to people. And again, then there is the reality of personal expression, which is you are expressing it because it is you to express it.
Right.
It's if you are personal. Expressing it in order to sell it, you've put the cart before the horse.
Exactly.
Your responsibility in terms of what you express, whether it be in a protest rally, giving a speech on the steps of the Lincoln Monument,
the soapbox
or making
in Hyde Park.
A film or doing a painting, what your responsibility is as the person making that expression, is to find the right tone.
Right.
Find the tone that best serves that which you wish to express. Because if you find that tone, no matter what happens right here, right now, with contemporary business and distribution apparatus, if you find the right tone, it will ambiate. Mm. That expression will take root. Does it mean you'll be financially rewarded? Perhaps not.
Perhaps.
And that might not be the reason that you were supposed to do it.
Right.
In the long, you know, if you can approach, if you're talking about creating personal expression and artistic expression as a business, as a lifelong pursuit, rather than this is one thing that I have to say and I want to get it out to as many people. If it's your business, if it's your livelihood, approach it like a gardener.
Right.
And stop fixating so much on the individual crop. Don't stand in front of that bush or that tree screaming, grow, grow. Why is it yielding the fruit that I need it to yield? Realize that you are the caretaker of this complete garden.
Ah.
And there is always something to be doing.
Right.
And that the rewards that come your way may surprise you, and they may be very far down the road, but that all things in the garden are interconnected, are they not? That how you tend to the entire garden will dictate whether or not that garden is fruitful.
Wow. What a lovely metaphor. Particularly after I've been in Provence eating grapes.
So how was Provence?
Oh, fantastic. I drank some spectacular wines.
You bicycled through the entire province of Provence.
I through the entire province of Provence. It was 6 days of hard riding and then a lot of stopping at great restaurants and medieval towns. Saw the Church Notre Dame of the Wolf, where apparently it was built on the seven coffins of Romans, and used it to scare away werewolves and vampires.
Oh.
Yes. Very cool. Anyway, I'll tell you all about it later. But
this would actually be the time.
But I wanted to get your opinion on our school closings, weather reports, and obituaries.
Claude Chabrol died?
Died yesterday. That was big news in France. You didn't hear a thing about it.
And I distributed so many of Claude Chabrol's films.
You're right. And it seemed that you had a personal relationship with
Hitchcock
him.
of France, the yes. Alfred Hitchcock of France, as he's been referred to.
80 years old, passed away a day and a half ago.
I did not realize that. Now, yeah. Claude Chabrol makes some really fun movies. You know what I will prepare then for next week is like five Chabrol films that everyone should see.
Now, please do, because you showed... I had to... the one I didn't like with Roddy...
No, Orson Welles.
No.
And Anthony Perkins.
Oh, yeah. That one. I couldn't get through that one.
Right.
That was sad. I really wanted to enjoy. This was my first experience with Chabrol.
Well, that was kind of... He made an English language film starring Orson Welles and Anthony Perkins in the 70s, early 70s. Yeah. And he'd kind of earned the right to make that because of, you know, all his successful films. And we see this still to this day of foreign language filmmakers who come to the States or make English language films there in Europe.
Right.
And it doesn't quite work.
Right. Aliens 4, I would
say. But he'd earned the right to do that. And as a failure, it's still so interesting.
Is it?
It's a really interesting failure.
Okay.
I mean,
I'll look at it again. I think I have a copy of it.
I think it's the film, isn't it kind of based on the Ten Commandments too? Or is it the Seven Deadly Sins?
Well,
I'll have to look at it again.
Please
but
do.
Next week, I'll come up with a list of Chabrol films. Because he made a lot of thrillers and suspense thrillers.
Right.
Of course,
he was very
influential.
He made
La Femme Infidèle, which was remade as Unfaithful. With Richard Gere and
Absolutely.
Diane Lane.
And he was influential to Jean-Luc
Well, he was one of the
new
wave.
Yes.
He started with the new wave filmmakers.
Yeah. So that's sad news.
Oh, I know.
I thought you would be all over that one.
Wow.
I know.
There is some kind of interesting show business news, development news. You know, we always talk about, we rant against...
the man in
you
development.
Know, the development and the remakes and the
And the new TV season with the Hawaii Five-O's and the Hoot the
Hawaii Five-O, it's the best reimagining. This is what the critics are saying. The best reboot of any classic TV series ever. Okay, name another good TV reboot.
I can't. Get Smart? There isn't one.
No, well, Battlestar Galactica.
Battlestar Galactica.
Which also starred Grace Park, who stars
on...
Yeah.
Okay, Battlestar
but
Galactica.
But still, okay, that was the one. I can't think of another great reboot from one series to another, and we've got a Rockford Files reboot coming.
Good.
Anyway, but the remake, as you know, from the old British series, which we consider a mini-series, that's being remade for television, Jean Le Carré's A Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. And we've talked about this before, how the cast... So excited in the role that Alec Guinness played of Smiley, George Smiley. Gary Oldman is playing the part. I mean,
that's
how wonderful. So great getting Gary Oldman getting a great quiet acting part. But anyway, Michael Fassbender, who has been really making a name for himself and was so good in Inglourious Basterds, he's been replaced. And he's been replaced by the man who is starting to get credit for what I said as soon as I saw it, for stealing the movie Inception, our old friend Tom Hardy.
Tom Hardy.
He's going to be in this Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy reboot, along with Gary Oldman and Colin Firth, and I forget who all else, but really wonderful casting.
Wow.
So I have high hopes for this.
That's
that
big
this
high
could
hopes.
Really be something.
The rest of it's looking sad, though. I got my TV preview. And I'm not really jumping over a lot of hoops for stuff.
But what about this television series that's being developed from Neil Gaiman's Sandman series?
How did I miss that?
How did you miss this?
Now I'm out of the loop.
Not being developed as features. Thank goodness.
Yeah. Because it's such an overwhelming
It's a whole
story.
Universe unto itself. Anyway, being developed as a television series.
What networks? HBO?
Oh, I don't know. I'll have to look into
that
now.
I would hope it's one of the cables that would give it the freedom to sort of run amok.
Now, I never was a big graphic novel kind of a guy.
Yeah.
But Sandman Preludes and Nocturnes was a multi-issue run that I really got into.
Oh, you did?
Because a character that I did like... John Constantine, Hellblazer, was part of that universe, and there was this whole trench coat brigade of these different characters who were kind of mysterious, always straddling the line of good versus evil, trying to maintain balance in the universe.
Yeah,
were part of that run. Anyway, I think that could be really quite.
How about
something.
That? I'm going to look for that. Was that coming out this season, or is it in development?
It's in development, probably for next season.
Okay. So we'll look into that. September 20th. I mean, that's the start of the new season. And
so, did you see anything? I mean, you had these long flights.
Okay. Well, you know, funny, my audio was broken on the flight back. 8 hours with nothing to watch. That was a bit. I tried to watch. Remember,
8 hours with nothing to watch is the perfect review of one of the films I saw, Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus.
Did you finally see that?
The best thing that happened for that film is Heath Ledger dying during the making of it.
Because that made that character three different...
Which thematically worked.
Really?
Having the character be played by other actors at different times. I'm not going to give anything away beyond that, like about when. It does really seem like what had been left to shoot was the CGI stuff.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, in certain scenes, other actors play the character... And it really worked, and I think they went back and reshot something to introduce this motif at the beginning of the film. That's one of the most interesting concepts in the whole film.
Really? The rest of it is...
But boy, what a mess. What a mess.
Wow. I'm shocked to hear that. Well, speaking of messes, David Duchovny, my good friend, had to see his movie, The Joneses. What a sleepwalk. Did you remember this movie came out? It was like there was no marketing to it.
Fairly popular in England, actually, in the UK while I was there.
Well, because there's a real American marketing ideal to this, that a family moves in, they're all hired, and they're hired to be this lifestyle where they go and play golf, and then, hey, look at this cool golf club I have, and then golf sale of that club go through the roof. That's the idea. Stealth marketing family stuck in a suburban... They're implanted in suburban areas all over the world. So what was shocking was once you got that idea, there was nothing else to the movie. And that was sort of presented in the first 20 minutes. So you had that first 20 minutes and there was no, it just sort of wafted after that. And then you go, well, why wasn't this movie marketed? How do you market a movie about marketing? Stealth market movie, you know.
Oh, my God. We've turned on ourselves that much.
Yeah. Though you can't even market a movie about marketing.
Yeah.
Because it's you're looking into a mirror that reflects itself a billion times down the...
What about this advertising campaign that goes on during the commercials of Mad Men, where there's a well-crafted parody of Mad Men, and each week it's a different product that's a sponsor of Mad Men that's being advertised within this pitch session at a 60s era Madison Avenue advertising.
Wow, campaign. I haven't seen that because I TiVo it and I fast forward through
you
all
really
the commercials.
You really need to see this.
Wow.
And I think AMC produces these spots.
That's
for
clever.
Each week a different, but I mean, it's all feeding itself.
Yeah.
It's really.
Well, this is what, you know, the argument is. Culture industry will finally eat its own tail and you won't recognize the commercial from the...
Oh, from the actual
thing.
Yeah, well, there is it. Yeah. Yeah. What do you? What else? Did you see anything else?
Yeah. Well, I had Metropolis on my phone on the iPhone. Nothing
you always,
like
every time. Right.
I fall asleep at that movie.
Some silent film on your phone.
I love it. I have Godzilla, and I'm getting Harold Lloyd all loaded up next week.
Go easy on Harold Lloyd. He's got to be very, very old by now. Get him all loaded up. See what I did?
Get it loaded up.
I've seen three new films.
Oh, tell me.
One of which is already in theaters. The American.
Oh, yeah.
Starring George Clooney. You know, got mixed reviews.
Yeah, I heard that.
But all the reviews, including the bad ones, made me think this could be really, really good. And indeed, it was really, really good.
Really?
Luke Y. Thompson gave it a pan. He said, if you like long, slow, quiet, lingering shots of George Clooney looking lovely in front of scenic Italian vistas, this is the movie for you.
Well, I do like that.
But he said that there's a real zen-like quality that might work to pull you in. And I think in our chaotic world, this film is a challenge for people because, you know, if you want your action suspense film to grab you by the balls and pull you in, then you're not going to like this. But this is, you know, very much... It's a Western, for crying out loud.
Wow.
And it's a Western in much the same way that Kurosawa's samurai films were Westerns. I mean, there really is the Zen-like quality. And
I got to do yoga before I see this.
But I think it's too easy. And again, it's one of those films that if it was a foreign language film, people would fall all over themselves loving.
Right, right.
Anyway, and it's even more quiet and still than, say, Michael Clayton.
Wow.
What I love about Clooney, though, is that he's really pulling from this 1970s era suspense thriller films.
Mm.
And let's face it, that's the last time that we really were doing suspense thriller films very, very well.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's really quite, there are some things that don't work, but it's really quite enjoyable.
American?
And you know what else? Even when it's not working, it's just about the coolest fucking film I've seen in a year.
Awesome. What's the other two? Quickly.
The new Woody Allen. You will meet a tall, dark stranger.
Ooh.
As always, the women come off quite well in a Woody Allen film, including Naomi Watts as the lead. It's refreshing seeing Anthony Hopkins.
Wow.
It's refreshing for both Anthony Hopkins to get to see him work with Woody Allen's material. And it's refreshing for Woody Allen to see a strong male actor who's not going to be doing Woody Allen.
Right. Not an impersonation.
If anything, it's almost like Antonio Banderas seems to be doing Woody Allen in the film. But when I say new Woody Allen, of course, there is no new Woody Allen. I long for a new Woody Allen. But even when he's on top of his game, like with Match Point, it's still not, quote unquote, new Woody Allen.
Right.
So it isn't without its charms, though, unlike, say, Whatever Works, which had no charms. But you know, if you catch it on a plane, you might enjoy it. Meanwhile, a film that had much in common with You Will Meet a Tall, Dark Stranger, thematically, in terms of tone, awkward tonal shifts, ensemble piece. But Stephen Frears' new film, Tamara Drew, based on the graphic novel, which in turn was based on a Thomas Hardy novel. Not Tom Hardy. Not our friend Tom Hardy.
No.
Thomas Hardy novel. But starring the gorgeous Gemma Arterton, who probably best... Well, this summer she's huge. She's been in Prince of Persia. She's been in The Clash of the Titans. But she played Strawberry Fields, Bond's ill-fated South American secretary in Quantum of Solace.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And she's so charming. And the cast is really wonderful. And again, it's got weakness, but it is so refreshing to see an ensemble character comedy.
Oh, it's comedy.
Where the actors have the integrity to do what they can to make it real.
Yeah.
And even if the shifts and the structure are sometimes awkward, and even though the one American character is so clearly patterned for Paul Giamatti, who they couldn't afford or who had gone to the well too often to want to do it, so they cast someone who really looks like Paul Giamatti.
Oh, my God.
And that's distracting. It's still, it's charming in the best sense of the word. So,
wow, there you
Tamara
go.
Drew is certainly fun. And that's what I've seen.
Fantastic. Well, as always, that's...
We went a little long. Sorry, Jackalope. Does Jackalope truncate us when we go long?
I'm not sure.
I don't think so. We should find out.
We should really find out.
Anyway, you know where to find every episode of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. Become a friend of the show on MySpace.
Yep.
MySpace.com/ChillPackHollywood.
Become a liker.
A liker. We're up to 750 plus likers.
Wow.
A year ago, we had less than 250.
Now we're 750. We're 1,000 by year end.
On Facebook. Facebook.com/ChillPackHollywood. These are great places to go when there is a problem getting the most recent show.
Won't happen
we
again.
We do keep in touch with everyone. We love hearing from our listeners.
Yes.
It really is your show. We'll talk about whatever it is you want to hear us talk about.
Write us at
Chillpack Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
ChillpackHollywood@yahoo.com. ChillpackHollywood@yahoo.com.
So easy.
We listen to we read those emails and we answer them on the air. As always, we're brought to you by Chillpack, the gel pack cooling device that takes your laptop computer and keeps it running fast and increases the lifetime expectancy of your laptop. It solves the complex problem of heat. By drawing heat away from the CPU.
So easy.
Check it out at chillpack.com, chillpack.com. I'm Phil Lake.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you next week.